friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel and Jumper and Comic Extension. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Mr. Chris Casso.
Good kutati.
That's never going to get old. Cole Hornaday.
I don't know what the heck he's talking about.
And Nicole Lamb.
I don't have a cute thing to say. Hi.
He's got this cute signature greeting, and we're just, you know...
And a cute smile that you can't see because you're not videotaping.
We're left in chopped liver land.
The Kotati, Chris, enlighten me. Are they considered extraterrestrials or are they considered terrestrial?
Extraterrestrial.
Oh. Well, look at that. What do you know? That leads nicely into our first topic of today.
What?
Which is UFO comics and comics concerning UFOs or extraterrestrials. Now, I know UFOs show up in a lot of comics, but are there any titles out there that are specifically about UFOs? Because when I was a kid, I loved reading stories about like sightings,
right,
you know, and like seeing like pictures that now are, you know, are fake, but looked like really cool, and all the, it's amazing because the ships advanced technologically as humans advanced, like the 50s UFOs looks like what a 50s UFO would look like. Now they're just like beams of light or whatever.
Well, I think UFO mythology was really reflective of our cultural position. I mean, in fact, our position here in the Pacific Northwest, do you know the origin?
Yeah, that's right. Go ahead.
Kenneth Arnold.
Yep.
Flying over Mount Rainier, June 24th, 1947. But the media permutated the language because he originally described what he saw as being more like crescent shapes that moved as though they were saucers being skipped across the surface of the
exactly.
water.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yep.
I did my research.
Yep.
Well, good for you.
Yeah, but yeah, but right here in Washington State is where that mythology came from. Well, there's, you know, you can go back further actually to World War II and the Foo Fighters. You know, just were mystery aircraft anyway. And you can also, you know, take a look at the work of Mr. Carl Jung, you know, and the mandalas in space and how mandalas in the sky and how UFOs are merely a reflection of our spiritual awakening cast into the skies. I think that's how it goes. I read that book, you know, back in the 80s. It didn't stick.
Very poetic, though. But the saucer terminology came out of that first story. Yeah.
So when I was a kid, Gold Key books comics were everywhere. And they were really, really very poorly written, poorly drawn. On poorly produced comic books, but gosh darn it, they had the coolest painted covers because you know that's what roped you. And they had a whole series of UFO comics published back in the day, back like in 1968 to like 1978. That were, I believe, ripped from the files of Project Blue Book. But again, they were not very good comics. A couple of years ago, my friend Denny Chong actually found a collection of them in like a box and gave them to me. And they're terrible, but they're terribly wonderful, and I'm really glad I have them.
They seem to have really gorgeous covers, which is what tended to happen on a lot of those types of comics.
But the interior illustrations are very poorly done. They're very rushed stories. And I don't know that there were ever any, you know, any decent, here you go. But there were very few comic books that could, you know, tell sturdy stories about UFOs. You know, aliens would come in and out of different stories. I don't think that UFO comics even popped up on the comic book radar until we got the X-Files, you know, and Topps did an X-Files comic back in, you know, between 95 and 98 that I, because I was such a freak for the TV show at the time.
I followed that for quite some time too. And actually that's where a lot of the artist of The Walking Dead,
Charlie Adlard,
did a ton of work for that. That was my first exposure.
Just a little preview for the Panel Jumper live show coming up in November.
November 18th at West of Lennon.
Stefano Gaggiano, who is the inker of The Walking Dead, will be our industry guest.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, very excited about having him on. So he is the gentleman who inks Charlie Adlard's work for Walking Dead.
Nice.
Just briefly, I'm looking at this UFOs Mysteries comic call that you had, and I don't know if it's an artifact of the printing process orifice. Like what you said, it's very rushed, but mm-hmm. the coloring looks like it was done with highlighters. And just very, like, somebody just slapping it across the page. I think
that was just a cheap printing process.
It's probably just a cheap printing,
for a lot of
yeah.
those comics, yeah.
It's great.
So when I think about UFO comics, I immediately think of, you know, like fourth, what is it, fourth? Fourth kind, whatever, like, you know, actually getting a contact with aliens.
Right. Oh, close encounters of the
third kind, first kind, second kind,
yeah,
and third.
Yeah, fourth is, I think, actual. I can't count right now. Anyway, yeah. There's counting involved.
There is. Yeah. Numbers are right.
I was told that there would be no math.
There's no math
it's
in
the universal language. You better have math when they come.
Oh, I thought universal language was, isn't that what Close Encounters taught us? It was music?
Music is math anyway, Nicole.
So there are a few modern comics that are happening right now that do deal with aliens or things like that. I know there's one that you like, Chris, called Resident Alien.
Yes.
That's a good one.
Oh, right,
yes.
Right.
That's Dark Horse.
That's one from
Can
Dark-
you briefly yeah. describe what that's about?
Well, so this alien crash landed on Earth like a while ago, like maybe 5-10 years ago, and he is empathic and slightly telepathic, so whenever people see him they see a human because he can kind of make that illusion in people's minds, and he's a pretty easygoing guy. He wants to be left alone. So he takes up shop in a small town, and he just kind of stays by himself next to the lake, but he is also a doctor. And the local town doctor has, I can't remember if they die or if they are injured. And so the sheriff comes by and he's like, hey, we need you to fill in for a while. And the alien's just like, man, if I say no, they're going to think something's weird. So he becomes the local town doctor. And he has a fascination with crime novels and pulp fiction. So little mini mysteries come to him in the small town. And he solves them because since he's a little bit telepathic, a little bit empathic, he can actually get them taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
They're miniseries. They're 4-issue runs. And then there's like another year before another one comes out.
Yeah.
So they're just quick
sporadic
one and done stories. Mm-hmm. But
it started
really
out
fun.
In the new Dark Horse Presents, right? In the anthology.
I think it actually predated that. But then like, the next volumes, they did feature it in there.
I really liked those stories. I thought they were really charming. And in a lot of ways, they reminded me of back in the 90s, Gerard Jones, I can't remember who drew it, tried to produce a Martian Manhunter miniseries that was set in the 50s. It was a very similar tone. That series failed. This one succeeds. And it's like, in reading it, I'm like, oh, this reminds me of the Jones series, and this is so much better. And I really would love another Martian Manhunter series where they explore his alien aspect like they did in the Tom Mandrake and the one in the 90s.
Yeah, blacking out on the other name. Mandrake and Ostrander.
Yes.
Yeah.
There you go.
I really enjoyed that series.
And then there's one that you've read, Ben, that a lot of us have read at Letter 44,
yeah,
where they find aliens at the end of our galaxy, mm-hmm, and there's military and scientific personnel going out there, and the war that we were experiencing with Iraq was actually just a cover for getting ready for a potential alien invasion.
Right, building up new technologies.
Exactly.
To the ruse of fighting that war was just to develop alien fighting technologies.
Right, and then there's Wild's End, which is kind of like War of the Worlds, but anthropomorphic characters. It's
War of the Worlds meets Wind in the Willows.
Yeah, so very, very
wow,
cool. And then there's Trees by Warren Ellis, that I think of as an alien encounter, where there's these long stalks that are kind of like trees that implant in the earth that just, they completely have a disregard for human life. They don't care. They're just...
They don't understand.
Now, are these alien stories, or are they flying saucer stories?
These are some alien stories. Okay. Like Letter 44, I do think of UFO because they do find a strange craft in space.
Gotcha.
And The Wild's End, there are weird things coming and doing kind of alien.
Yeah, they're very much tripods.
Yeah.
And they kind of follow that old style form of like the UFO landing.
Mm-hmm.
So Ben kind of established early on that when flying saucers showed up on the scene in comics and drive-in movies and B-movies, they were kind of a reflection of Cold War anxieties,
mm-hmm,
especially like Earth versus the Flying Saucers and Invasion of the Saucer Men. And then we get
I don't know if that's what I said, but that makes me sound smart.
Day of the Earth Stood Still. Yes, you did say all those things in subtext. And then we have the X-Files that give us aliens that are, again, a reflection of cultural anxieties. These stories that you were sharing just now, do they reflect anything, a trend?
They're all very, very different across the board, and go from a different array of, from strange UFOs in space that we're trying to deal with in a very bad human way, like the Letter 44, to something like Resident Alien, where somebody... a creature comes down and incorporates in American society. And there's probably something in societal standards and different things like that maybe they explore. I'm not sure. Wild's End is a little bit more of that, I feel, throwback sort of to the 1950s.
It's sadly worth mentioning Independence Day, too, because that was a comic, and there was a comic for the sequel.
and you reviewed it.
And that is, it's as far as cultural relevance, it's like, it's the 9/11 syndrome stuff.
Also
our mass devastation, you know, we love to see ourselves get shot and die. So I kind of like...
Speak for yourself, buddy.
I try to get shot once a week. But I like to think that the new wave of stuff is just like, well... we're done with that peak depression. Let's do some other fun stuff.
And then there's strange things like the Transmetropolitan, where they had the alien, the Grays DNA spliced with humans, and they were trying to get their rights, and that was a whole nother thing.
Right. There's a new comic from Dark Horse called Cryptozoology, or Cryptozoic. Or something
there
like that.
There was a cryptozoology, too, I think, or something.
Didn't we cover that in a previous episode?
We did, but maybe not that one.
No, and the little gray men landed, and they are just kind of stupid stoners, and they monitor the world's governments for us or the government uses them to monitor every other government using their telepathy, and they just feed them Mountain Dew and Cheetos.
And let them play video games.
And they're just like, you know what? We're too lazy to leave this planet, and you guys take care of us, so you got us.
So kind of like little Men in Black guys, you know, like the ones that were always just goofing off.
The worm
off.
Guys?
Yeah.
That reminds me of a Bill Hicks routine where he talks about seeing a... because aliens only show themselves to Hicks in southern towns, and so he's afraid seeing an alien ship up on blocks in some redneck's yard. And, we're just going to come down here and whittle some.
Thank you for Bill Hicks.
Is that the Men in Black was actually based on an independent black and white comic book from Air Cell back in the
80s. Oh, there you go.
And I meant to go back
and
look at
those. Which was based on an actual government program, right, Cole?
I don't know what you're talking about, Ben. The film version, the film adaptation of the comic book.
So
was
much better.
Far more successful.
So much better.
But the one bit I do remember liking about the comic book was that when they would meet ambassadors or liaisons from outer space, they did it at comic book conventions. Because the aliens could blend in. I'm like, oh, well, that's cute. I like that. I haven't really checked. There was a time when those comic books were quite valuable and when the movie was
very, very popular.
No, I don't think they are either.
All right.
I should not have held on to them.
Do we have any final words on UFO comics?
I'm sure there's more and there's more things spliced into stuff. Yeah. I wrote UFOlogy, but I actually don't know anything about it. They just have flying saucers on the cover.
I think I may have mentioned this in past episodes. There was a time where I wanted to write a play about alien abduction mythology, and I kind of got, you know, I kind of bored into a lot of research and stuff and got mired in it and just gave up because it's really problematic and disturbing kind of mythology that we don't really hear about anymore, probably because stuff like The X-Files is not on the airwaves, is not in public consciousness. Yeah. But there's that aspect of, that's where the UFOlogy went, and where that went, I don't know. I kind of gave up on pursuing it. Even though I read the 40 times every month.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, that's UFO Comics. If you want to check out any more UFO Comics, visit your friendly local comic book store. Let's move on to our next topic. And a couple of weeks ago, we mentioned Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's take on Mycroft Holmes. Apparently, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar wrote... maybe an entire series or just an episode of the Sherlock Holmes comic about Mycroft. And that got me thinking about, that got us thinking about transmedia creators and what other non-comic book creators have become, delved into the world of comics, be it authoring or drawing or coloring, editing, whatever. Now, I know Kevin Smith did a run of Daredevil, right?
Yeah. Daredevil, mm-hmm. Spider-Man.
And, Spider-Man, Clerks Black comics.
Man. Yeah.
And Batman, which was atrocious.
Well, the Widening Gyre.
So it doesn't always work.
Yeah. There was, like,
it doesn't always work.
Too.
Well, he's infamous for not either finishing a story or delaying it so excruciatingly long you don't care anymore.
Yeah. Mostly don't care.
Yeah. The Black Cat. How long did it take him to finish the Black Cat Spider-Man series?
Quite a while. And Bullseye never finished.
Bullseye never finished.
Period, yeah.
And I think did he not write the Detective Comics series? Or am I thinking of... No, never mind. That was Engelhart. But I thought the Widening Gyre one left on the first arc of the story ended on a cliffhanger that was never concluded.
I didn't bother to read it, so I can't speak to that.
But we have a lot of other really great people that we can talk about.
What other examples are there?
Like Ta-Nehisi Coates is a good one to start with. Exactly. I mean, he's a novelist who's become a comic book writer. And everyone who's working on the Women of Wakanda stuff are also writers or poet.
And that's... Roxane Gay and Yana Harvey.
Yep, and they'll be breaking into comics as well. And you have a few more, Chris.
So Joe Hill, novelist Joe Hill,
right.
Son of the Stephen King.
The Stephen King.
Yes.
Joss Whedon did a
Stephen King. The concept.
Did a couple runs of X-Men, Astonishing X-Men, and he also, there's the Buffy's, he's in the 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, whatever.
Did he write all of those? I was trying to remember.
He
but
like
he had a hand in the first couple. Right. But also, is it Amber Benson, the girl who played Tara from Buffy, did a few issues.
Yes, she did.
But then we've also got Alyssa Milano helped create a comic called Hacktivist for Archaea, which is actually a very interesting read. It's like a political thriller. Christos Gage is a screenwriter that's worked on Law and Order and the Daredevil Netflix show. He does a ton of comics. He does a lot of Marvel, DC, did some Avengers, does a lot of independent stuff. He's working on Buffy comics right now.
Mm-hmm.
The Wachowskis, who are no longer brothers.
They're sisters.
Nope. The sisters. The Wachowski sisters worked on Doc Frankenstein, and they also did Matrix comics.
Well, they had their own company. They had
Burly Man Press.
Yeah, Shaolin Cowboy and...
Doc Frankenstein.
And Doc Frankenstein, was there not a Matrix?
Then the Matrix.
Did you say that already?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Briefly, have you read any of the Matrix comics? Has anybody read any of the Matrix comics? Yeah. Are they worth it?
They're anthology.
Do they make the movies any better?
They're unnecessary. They're anthology. they're anthologies with a lot of guest artists, so it differs from story to story.
Nah.
But Peter Bagg did one where basically it was kind of like reading an issue of Hate where the character knows he's in the Matrix or something.
Yeah. Mm. One of our favorite books, Black Sad, the artist on that, Juanjo Guanido, he's worked for Disney.
He worked on Tarzan.
Yeah, he worked on Tarzan, and he did the metal band video, and there's a hardcover that we have in store called Freaky Project.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's Gerard Way, right?
Gerard Way of My Chemical Romance.
Yep, he's
currently
one.
Working on Doom Patrol, but he's known for the Umbrella Academy.
Umbrella Academy, right?
Yep, and he's been given his own imprint completely by DC called Young Animals.
Oh, my. Yeah. Oh, that is his. Okay.
That's his.
One of my favorites is a one-shot by Trace Ballou of Mystery Science Theater.
Oh, yeah.
It was called Here Come the Big People and drawn by Jeff Darrow. I think it was published by Event Comics.
He did the cover. Amanda Connor did the interior.
Oh, thank you for that correction.
Okay. That's pretty cool.
I thought he'd drawn the inside and someone else inked it, but I think you're right.
It would take an act of God to get more work from Jeff Darrow.
Yeah, that's true. I read it once, and then actually Blue was in town for touring and was signing at Scarecrow Video.
Oh, yeah?
And I had him sign it for me.
I saw him. He did a stand-up set at Chop Suey about 2 years ago that I saw. Yeah, with Frank Conniff and Dana Gould. They opened for Dana Gould.
Was it the same time when they were touring the Cinematic Titanic?
I have no idea.
Oh, okay.
Patton Oswalt did a Justice League comic that's one of my favorites called Welcome to the Work Week.
Yep. And Brian Posehn did Deadpool.
Oh, yeah. Love me some Brian Posehn. And then
Tom King, who's currently doing Batman, is an ex-CIA officer and wrote a novel called Once Crowded Sky. So he's more known for getting and becoming famous for that.
And he also does The Vision.
I was going to say, yeah, isn't he writing
The Vision? Yeah, he's doing The Vision. Yep. He did Omega Man.
Yep.
So, yeah.
And everything that he's touched has been pretty stellar and well-received, too, in the comic book world.
The Vision.
So it sounds like there's a lot of crossover. I wonder how do these people get into writing for comics? Is it like is it stunt casting?
Well, there was a big movement from the 2000s. I would say like the era of like the late 90s. Like right at the tail end, 98, 99 into 2000 to 2010. Marvel specifically was just like, hey, Kevin Smith likes comics. Mm-hmm. Let's do thing. And they just kept at it. And that's why you also get a lot of crap from people, too. Yeah.
And a lot of mystery writers. Who wrote... go ahead.
No, mystery writers?
Yeah, the Identity Crisis.
Oh, Brad DC. Meltzer.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He was a best-selling murder mystery writer.
Yeah.
And I remember reading a brief interview with him that said, I just do this for fun because I can't see how anybody makes a living doing comic books. And I would come in like, I was kind of like, you know, you buddy.
Now, well, you know what? It is actually really hard to make a living doing comic books.
Sure. Some of that happens through connections because I think Meltzer went to college with, I can't remember if it was Mark Waid or somebody from that era. But there was... sorry, I think I just lost track of what I was going to say.
Well, I thought that Meltzer was part of an actual editorial trend to get known authors into the industry to help sort of, and also to help, you know, revitalize how the stories are being told. Because, like it or not, Identity Crisis had a pretty hefty impact on the DC universe at the time.
Quite a bit,
It set all kinds of really ugly things in motion that I kind of blame on the trends that we're seeing now. But
I just remembered I was going to mention Bob Gale. So Marvel did a lot of it, but DC chimed in and they got Bob Gale, who's the writer of Back to the Future, to do Batman. Mm-hmm. And he also did a Daredevil run that predates Bendis, and he did what Bendis did and no one cared, and then Bendis did it and everybody cared, which was unmask Matt Murdock.
Uh-huh. Publicly?
They did a whole a whole story, and then he was just like, they proved that he wasn't Matt Murdock, and then like Bendis did it again, and it's just like, that guy's been proven to be Daredevil like 20 times now.
Is this all in the same Daredevil universe?
Yeah, right. Same time
frame. It's not even like there's been a reboot in
it's
between
like
those
half a year
events.
Later it
nice.
Happened again.
Oh, comic books.
So as you can see, I mean, then there's probably even more that we could go into and research and stuff. So,
in fact, there's probably some comic book writer listening to this podcast going, I wrote a screenplay. I am a transmedia creator.
And as a transition, J. Michael Straczynski, who wrote for Babylon 5 and a bunch of other things. Teen Wolf? No, that was Jeff Loeb.
He wrote, he created and produced Babylon 5. He was the showrunner on that. Sense8, the series on Netflix that's produced by the Wachowskis, which I watched a couple weeks ago and thoroughly enjoyed, and I'm looking forward to the next season.
Sense9.
Straczynski did
Jeremiah
Supreme Power, which is a comic series that's a tribute to the Squadron Supreme.
Ah, which is a nice transition, as you said, to our next topic.
I saw what you did there.
Hashtag, we're good at transitions.
Exactly. All right, so what Chris just said, our final topic for today is we're going to be talking about Squadron Supreme, the Secret Squadron, and the genesis of Nighthawk. Now, this was just mentioned a couple of weeks ago, and I think, Cole, you said that we could talk a lot about this, or we should talk about this. So I'm going to let you guys talk about this. I have no idea what the genesis of Nighthawk or Squadron Supreme are, so take it away.
So maybe let me just set one thing up, and then I'm going to let you handle a lot of the Grunewald stuff. Does that sound good?
No.
No?
Okay. No, I actually had a totally different viewpoint of how we were going to approach this.
Do it. Do it.
No, not at all. I'm like, I know. Well, essentially, Squadron Supreme is an analog to the Justice League.
Right.
And I think started out in where characters originally introduced in the Avengers.
Yep.
And I want to say it was was it Steve Gerber that introduced him? That could be wrong.
No. I kind of thought it was Roy Thomas, but I didn't bother to do that part.
And, you know, they sort of got some fan appeal, and they kept showing up in other comics. So they exist in a parallel dimension to the Marvel universe. At least they did at the time. But it was in the 80s, early 80s, when Mark Gruenwald, and I can't remember, I think it was a bunch of different artists, Bob Layton may have been one of them, they produced a 12-issue maxi-series that sort of, you know, told the dark and dirty story of the Squadron Supreme. It was fairly successful, but it predated things like Watchmen. And it predated a lot of the grim and gritty team hero books that, you know, that came along later. And frankly, probably did a better job. But go ahead.
So you pretty much kind of did what I thought we were going to do there. but basically, just to give context for why the Squadron can be problematic at times, is so there's the Squadron Supreme, and they are an analog of the Justice League.
Yep.
And then to make that more confusing, there's the Squadron Sinister, which is the evil version duplicates of the Squadron Supreme. Now.
Okay, hold on. No, keep going. Just I'm telling the audience to hold on to that.
See, do I need to start a spreadsheet?
It gets messy.
The thing is, the Justice really League messy. Already have evil duplicates called the Crime Syndicate of America. Uh-huh. So you just did like a duplicate analog of an analog or something there. And so for a while you had the two of them running through the Avengers stuff through the 70s, blah, blah, blah. Then you have the Gruenwald era, and Gruenwald stuff is fantastic. Mm-hmm. Like you said, it predates Watchmen. It's kind of, it's the Marvel Watchmen is what it is to me.
Yeah. It's just not as smart or grim or gritty.
Right. But it has some interesting things about superheroes becoming totalitarian.
Yeah, and the hubris of being of that kind of power that Marvel never really discussed.
And it predates Civil War in that it basically set it up as their Batman, who is a Nighthawk, was kind of like, nah, I don't quite like this. And so you get like a division of teams fighting each other. Mm-hmm. So then the next thing I was just going to kind of go into was the fact that, like, throughout the rest of the 80s and 90s, like, they were kind of a footnote. Not too many people cared. Gruenwald came back to it for a graphic novel once, and that was pretty interesting, but they dealt with the death of their world. Mm-hmm. And then Straczynski brought them back up for Marvel.
Well, before we move on to that, little side note, Gruenwald was never a big rock star writer. But he was particularly proud of the 12-issue maxi-series of Squadron Supreme. And when he died, he asked that his ashes were included in the printer's ink of the original print run of the graphic novel. I believe that is true. That's not a that's not an urban myth. And I always thought that was very quaint and very sweet. But, yeah, so there's a little bit of Mark in every edition of the Squadron Supreme. So go ahead.
And I kind of believe that's where they should have ended. They should have just stopped right there because now things get messy.
Well, you're talking about the Supreme Power, and I have fond memories of Supreme Power. I like J. Michael Straczynski, but a lot of folks understandably have a lot of trouble with his storytelling. So
here's my problem with Squadron Supreme. He already did it. He did it in Rising Stars.
Yes, he did.
Which was his version, his analog of The Watchmen, his deconstruction work. And so he basically regurgitated all over the Squadron Supreme. And it's just kind of like, well, you kind of got your peanut butter and the chocolate, but you made them both into like pickles and something else. I don't know. This is terrible. And it just went on and on. And so Marvel just kept on milking it. There were iterations that happened after him. And you ended up with the Ultimate Universe version of them. And they basically just kind of kept on saturating to the point where it got ridiculous and you kind of started to lose track of what version you're reading. Mm-hmm. And then finally, Secret Wars happened.
Yep.
And there was one particular book there where essentially they brought back the Squadron Sinister. And they even killed the Straczynski versions, which I was like, hooray, you're cleaning it up. You're going for a simple version here. But then they turn it into a murder mystery, and they kind of turned it into Watchmen. And at this point, it was like meta within meta with a little bit more meta thrown in for the sake of being 100% meta. It was just references, and that's all the Squadron Supreme become now. Mm-hmm. That's all we are at. It's just them trying to be wonky about what is this a reference to. Mm-hmm. So I missed the Grunwald run. It should have been just like, let's retire the characters.
Gotcha.
And that's where I want us to be now.
And you know, I was thumbing through my copy when I was thinking about what we wanted to talk, how we're going to approach this, and I was like, I should reread this.
And did you?
Well, no, it's 12 issues, and you know how busy my life is.
Right? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
He had to read UFO Mysteries first.
I did. I had all these other books I had to read
right
for
choice.
Book report, and then stuff, and the other stuff, and stuff. And
so
which brings us to Nighthawk, right?
Yeah, Nighthawk a member of the Squadron Supreme?
He's the Batman analog.
And now this version of Nighthawk is the Straczynski version of Nighthawk.
Yeah.
That's confusing because, like we mentioned when we previously mentioned Nighthawk, that the current Squadron Supreme, all of its members are from different realities. So it's not one team from one alternate reality. It's a team of five or six people, each one from a different reality.
And is that just messy storytelling, or is that part of the story?
Yes.
Yes and no.
Yeah. So wait,
yes and yes.
You said that they killed the
In Secret Wars.
Straczynski. Yeah.
But everybody died in Secret Wars.
So then they would have killed the Nighthawk in that series, but because we rebuilt the world after Secret Wars or whatever, then he's pulled out of a something or other.
Yeah.
That Franklin thought of course.
Seven versions of Cyclops died during Secret Wars.
Right.
And then he
nobody
came back.
Cared.
Nobody cared.
And then he.
Not even the writers. They didn't even mention it.
I cared. But,
so did I.
And then apparently he came back to life after Secret War, only to be killed off panel. So it's just like watching the third X-Men movie. So right now, the Suicide Squad, the Squadron Supreme, I want to commit suicide. That's what it is. They're just a mess to me. And so that's why this Nighthawk, a lot of people, you know, are talking about why it's being canceled and all that, but it's just like, it's Nighthawk. He was never going to sell, 100,000 copies.
He's a Batman analog.
There was a series a while ago that I read that was old when I read it, 7 years ago, that was a Nighthawk series. And was that Supreme Power then?
Yeah.
Okay, because I enjoyed that. I can't tell you what happened in it at this point.
You might have also read... So for a while, Nighthawk was in the Defenders or one of the Nighthawks.
Did
way back, yeah.
His
back.
Own series.
He had a couple miniseries.
Okay,
that
so I must have read
from,
one of those miniseries.
I think that we were talking about it off mic. I think one of the positive takeaway from the Straczynski Supreme Power series is the lovely artwork of Gary Frank, which I will never get tired of. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes I admit I get caught up in the artwork and I kind of look past how lame the story might actually be.
Gary Frank did some of the DC Universe rebirths, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was really good.
Which has Watchmen stuff that he drew.
Right.
Yeah. Now the thing is, like, there are strengths in that Supreme Power. It's just for me, I felt that it was regurgitated strengths.
It was.
And that's where I have a problem. Because Rising Stars was a very intelligent version of the Watchmen. Yeah.
Is there a secret? Wow, I can't talk anymore. Secret Squadron, because that's on here, but I don't know if that was a thing or we just started putting in adjectives because
I think we probably did.
Okay. That might have been my mistake in just
which is
to,
fine because it's confusing anyway, so it kind of works I think with everything.
Can't decipher my scribbling when I write something during the show. So. Cool.
Sorry.
I don't know if I don't know if I've learned anything new.
No. I'm bitter at them because they broke me at Secret Wars because the writer Mark Guggenheim was trying to be very clever and he never actually had a payoff. And once you're dealing with analogs and parodies and all that, like it happens so much. I actually think we need to at a certain point say stop making Superman characters that are not Superman.
Right.
Like we have Superman. If you can't tell a good Superman story, then tell something else.
Yep.
And I mean that's Hyperion from the Squadron Supreme.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep wanting to say Suicide Squad. And,
Suicide Squadron
Supreme.
Well,
he becomes evil at certain points
he's
in
evil
time,
half the time.
Right?
There was Kurt Busiek loves to bring up obscure Marvel stuff, and he brought them up more than once in his Avengers run. And there was a certain point where Captain America just walked up to them, and he just said, "Stop it." You're annoying to all of us. You're always being taken over by evil masterminds. Your good half days, your evil other days. We're done with you.
You're boring.
I kind of want there to be an editorial memoriam where basically it's just like, hey, you're going to be working for Marvel? You can't do the Squadron Supreme. I don't care if you have a hip new take on them.
Steve said so.
All right. Cool. So, but I did learn something. Nighthawk is a Batman analog, or as I like to call him, a Batmanalog. And with that, we're going to move on to Book Aboard, everybody. #these are the jokes.
Yes.
All right. Let's move on to Book Report. And Chris, let's start with you.
So I read Hadrian's Wall number 1 from Image. It is by Kyle Higgins and Alex Siegel on story and Rod Rice on artwork. And I believe this was the creative team that did Cowl from Image. And it's a very engaging number 1. It's a sci-fi story that takes place in 2085. It has a nice opening shot of Seattle in the future.
What?
And of course, it's from the view of where the Space Needle is.
Where it might be in the future.
Oh, that's true.
Maybe it can move in the future.
It's a rocket.
It starts with an astronaut in space, and his suit has a crack, and he dies a horrible death, and he says a woman's name. So the main character is a investigator with a lot of problems who's being hired to confirm that it was just an accident in space. That's where the sci-fi aspect of the story is like, okay, cool, whatever. But the drama is what actually really brings the story together, because it turns out that the guy who died in space shot the investigator over a feud over the investigator's then wife, who is now his ex-wife. And the ex-wife is on the spaceship. And so there's like all these questions about why did they get in this guy to specifically do the investigation?
His name wasn't Major Tom, was it?
So it's a very interesting mystery rolled up in a sci-fi story. And it's got some very engaging artwork and a solid first issue. So Hadrian's Wall number 1 is only $3.99. It's a really good first Image issue. We're checking out.
Just by the way, there's like 12 astronaut-themed Image projects happening currently. Right?
Yeah, no, I made a display where it's just astronauts on the cover because there's
cracked faceplates and helmets.
Faster Than Flight, Faster Than Light came out.
Yep.
Can I see that?
Yeah.
Hadrian's Wall, there's Horizon, but then there's also something called Frontier that Hickman's coming out with.
And they all have astronauts on the cover.
They're all astronauts on the cover. I think there's more like 5.
Is this a miniseries? I forgot.
I believe it's a miniseries because these creators tend to almost only do miniseries.
Okay.
It doesn't say it on there anywhere, but I think it may be just a 6 or 8-parter. Which I think they tell good stories.
I'm just looking to see if it's a realistic depiction of Seattle than
the
space.
But it's the future, Ben.
That's right.
All right. So Hadrian's Wall. Thanks, Chris. Cole Hornaday, what did you read?
Well, you know, I'm kind of stuck, guys, because I forgot, you know, as some of you may know, we record the Perfect Bound podcast in what I like to call a triptych. We have three episodes in a row. And I was prepared to do 3 book reports this evening. And
now you have to choose.
And now I have to choose because we had to drop one. So
what does your heart tell you?
My heart is so broken right now, Chris. I don't think I even want to. It's between the Sex Criminals Volume 3 or the latest Afterlife with Archie.
Well, do you want a good review or a bad review?
They both are going to be problematic. Let's do Afterlife with Archie because Chris and I were talking a little bit about it beforehand, and I like looking to him for support when my brain starts to frazzle. So it's Afterlife with Archie number 10. As you all know, this is one of my favorite comic books. And for the first time in this series, I actually got a little bit miffed in how the stories are being told. In this issue, we introduce Josie and the Pussycats, who are, you know, part of the Archie universe. And I do believe that Nicole will be reviewing the other styled Josie, in the Pussycats. So this is Josie and the Pussycats in the, you know, Afterlife evil universe that I believe also the Sabrina Lovecraftian stories sort of fit into.
Earth-Z.
Love it, yep. Archie Earth-Z. Can you remind me of that next time?
I'll try.
So what happens is that the plot from the previous story arc in Archie concluded with issue 9. This story with that introduces our new version of our dark and bloody version of Josie and the Pussycats has nothing to do with Archie. Nothing to do with them. It starts out, actually, if anything, it's a rather hackneyed homage to Anne Rice. And I never rant about Anne Rice because the 90s are behind me now. but it seriously, I guess Mr. Aguirre Sacasa was trying to pay an homage to the Anne Rice stories, literally Interview with a Vampire, because literally the story opens in a hotel where a reporter is interviewing Josie and he asks her to tell the story of her origin. And it is a vampire story that goes back to starting in 1906, where she and the three women who make up the band are actually living in an orphanage, and things happen. And they meet this wealthy kind of playboy, and they go off to... Oh, I'm sorry. Let me back up. They formed a band because they're musically inclined. Not a band. A quartet of singers, flappers. And then they get invited to perform on this estate. And what? The estate is run by a wealthy man of the evening? That didn't sound right at all. He's a vampire. He seduces them. He turns them into vampires. And then we have vampire rock stars who, you know, surface in every era and are responsible for musical trends, all from, rockabilly to disco to, you know, acid rock and whatever, all the way up to the present. I was really, really disappointed in this story because I didn't feel like it had one original moment in it. And I was frustrated because I've been thoroughly enjoying the arc of each and every arc of the Archie story. And I was confused why we had to stop, put the brakes on that story, and then tell the standalone story. And Chris had a theory as to why that would happen.
Well, it's world building.
Yeah.
And, in a book where you're killing most of the Riverdale cast,
right,
you have to remember to replenish them from time to time.
Okay.
And I'm waiting for Kevin to become Ash from Army of Darkness or something.
Yes, gotcha. I want that.
You know,
okay.
So I think
that doesn't happen in this.
No.
We never come back. In fact, the story doesn't even overlap with the Z stories.
But setup, I mean, long game.
Okay.
You know, that's right. Something.
Long
because the thing
game.
Is, the Sabrina stuff uh-huh. was long game. Sabrina's in the first issue. You don't see her until the Bride of Sabrina story, or Bride of Cthulhu story. And then you don't see her again until the number 9, where they connect her to Reggie. So, that's, you know.
See, I'm still, where the Sabrina story is concerned, I'm still a little bit dubious as to whether that actually does dovetail with the afterlife with Archie Zombie stories. I'm kind of seeing Sabrina as being its own thread in and of itself. It's self-contained. I'm still not convinced that what's happening in the Sabrina book is going to weave into the Archie stories.
I'm not talking about the Sabrina book. I'm talking about Sabrina in Afterlife
Sabrina
with Archie.
Okay.
Because she's a line throughout
folks,
all
if you
the
think you're
issues.
Confused.
Yeah, no. Because, I mean, she was... Yeah, it's like her connection point in Afterlife with Archie starts at number 1, shows up again at number 7 or something like that, 6 or 7, and then she just pops up again to deal with Reggie. So, she's key to me. Afterlife with... Or The Adventures of Sabrina, the separate book by the same writer, let's call that Earth S, okay? And that's the
For
witch
Sabrina.
Book. This is the zombie Cthulhu book.
Right.
And then there's Millennial Archie Land. We'll call that Earth M.
Which is what I'll be reviewing.
Yep. Yes. And I feel that sooner or later, maybe there will be some playthrough on these characters that you just read about.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to keep on introducing more material into this title to give it longevity. So I feel that's
okay.
You know, par
Fair
for
enough.
Course. For
Fair me. Enough. I am curious. I mean, I'm not going to give up on the book. I just thought it was Archie to this point has been a wonderfully stylized pastiche. pastiche in a good way. Borrows from all the George A. Romero rules that have been established in zombie stories that we've been celebrating for a while. And this fell back on stuff that bores me. And, you know, it fell back on vampire storytelling tropes that I just think are really boring and I didn't want to go back and revisit. But I hear what you're saying about world building, all for that. And I hear what you're saying about, you know, long game.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm not going to give up on the book.
It just didn't work for you.
It just didn't work.
Different than Long Pig, which, you know, maybe we'll get to the cannibal apocalypse part soon too.
All right. Well,
don't Google that.
After Life with Archie.
Life with Archie.
You can't please Cole all the time.
No, you can't.
All right. So let's warp from Earth Z to Earth M. And Nicole, what do you want to tell us about?
So the Josie.
Take over my water. We're all good.
Josie and the Pussycats number one came out somewhat recently, and this is in line with the Archie that Mark Waid is writing and the Jughead that Sadarsky is writing. So it's the same world in that regard. And Josie and the Pussycats, they're a band.
Yep.
They actually in the back of this issue give you some backstory on it, which I thought was pretty interesting. But before I derail this completely, it is written by Marguerite Bennett, and art is by Cameron DiOrdio, and coloring by Andre, lettering by Jack. You know, people and stuff like I'd like to do. What are you looking at?
Artist is Audrey Mock, actually.
Oh,
who I really like.
What does Cameron do?
Co-writing.
Oh, co-writing. Interesting. Interesting. So a little backstory on my bias on Marguerite Bennett before I go into this thing is I find her to be a very heavy-handed, overly literarily flourished human in her comic writing. So I'm not a big fan, to put it lightly. In fact, when I read that was her on it, I went, no!
She did. I was there.
Yeah, that happened like last night. So it starts off with Josie at this bar. There's like one guy there and he doesn't even care that she's singing, but she's just by herself and she's, you know, the struggling artist and the bartender there at the Boozesome, Winsome Boozesome in Riverdale, nice. Which is pretty cute.
I want to go to that.
Yeah, right. It's cute. And the bartender is very cute. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, she's supporting her and everything like that. But then the antagonist that comes in, which is like her old friend who looks like Veronica, who's not named Veronica, is coming in to just be, you know, a brat to her. She lives with Melody, who's the blonde drummer. And she meets Valerie, who is the bassist, I think, and also a backup singer. And it's just setting up the scene on them, but then there's no context for any of that literary flourish that I was talking about that Marguerite Bennett does in the character that is Josie. So like Josie meets this woman and she hears her sing and she realizes that there's this benefit for animals that maybe if she formed a band, she could, you know, have this woman be a part of it. And just comes in really heavy-handed with some dialogue that just seemed like really off-putting. And there's even a thing where Melody's on a date where she's just like, yeah, I don't really want to do music. You know, I'm too busy being social and dating a lot and all this stuff. But then when she's on the date, she has some weird thing like, oh, narrative parallels, gotcha. And like it sets up some weird stuff there because she sees a cat in the street or something. So there's some points in it that throw me off because it doesn't seem to make sense for the characters that are in the world. And that's where Marguerite, I think, is part of that in the writing. But overall, I think it followed the formula of what you would expect Josie and the Pussycats. Like, they form the band, they pull together, and they become, like, a team, and they're really, really good, and they get signed to a label, and, oh, it's the beginning. It's very exciting. So as far as that, they were successful in it, but then there were just some areas that fell really flat and were very confusing. So
we both had problems with Josie stories.
We did. We had some Josie problems.
The Coles are not down with the Josie.
The Coles are not.
Oh, man.
I will say this is much better than Adam Hughes' Betty and Veronica.
Mm. Yeah, most anything is.
But everything is.
Whatever happened
is.
To that one?
Number two hasn't shown.
Yeah, I was going to say.
The art's gorgeous in that. I really enjoy the art in this one. I feel like it's pretty good for having a modernized take. It's kind of, you know, sort of standard fare at this point. And you get a reprint of the Josie and the Pussycats, Pussyfootin' by Dick Malmgren. So I give this like a C. Like, you know, like Suicide Squad, it had some problems, but it also had some good points to it. So I kind of feel like it's in line with Suicide Squad.
All right.
That's my gauge now for a C.
Wow. There we go. All right. Well, thanks, Nicole. And that's Book Report, and that's our show. And coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com, as well as the Comics Dungeon here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, Woo! Or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. You can subscribe to the podcast via iTunes or any RSS reader of your choice at perfectboundpodcast.com. Send us an email if you want, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. What did we get right? What did we get wrong? Send us quiz time questions. And speaking of people sending us quiz time questions, get your quiz hats on, everybody. What? This week, our questions come to us from a regular quiz time contributor, our pal Buzzy.
Oh,
he's a big supporter of ours. He's a good friend of ours. And I found these today. I realized I hadn't used them yet, and I was really happy because, like I said a couple weeks ago, I forgot to write them.
He came in recently, and I said, are you my pal?
This is called Nuclear Option. Radiation has killed more people than Cecil B. DeMille. And yet, in the world of comics, a few well-placed isotopes can work miracles. For instance, number one, this character, originally created by Steve Ditko in the 1960s, eventually found his way to Earth 4 during DC's Crisis on Infinite Earths. In this incarnation, an Air Force officer agrees to an experiment involving alien metal and an atomic bomb. There's more of the question, but Cole, you have the answer. Who is it?
Captain Atom.
Yes, sir. Number two. The very different characters... Number two, two very different characters have shared one atomic moniker over the years. The first is a nuclear physicist from Red China whose irradiated skin glows green. The second resides in the world of The Simpsons and has a sidekick named Fallout Boy. What is the name that they share?
It's Radioactive Man.
It is Radioactive Man. Number three, this nuclear man is also a fusion of two chaps, high school student Ronnie Raymond and physicist Martin Stein. What name do they go by in this composite state?
Firestorm.
Yes, Storm.
Yes, Storm.
Number four.
I'm inspired by Storm.
This evil cyborg has the brain of murderer John Corbin, but the heart of his metal body... but the heart of his metal body is fueled by the radiation from a chunk of kryptonite. Can you name him?
Metallo.
Yes, Metallo. And finally, number five, the Marvel superhero Jewel gained her super strength when the car she was traveling in collided with a military vehicle carrying radioactive chemicals. Although her family perished in the accident, her series on Netflix has proven to be very popular. Who is this? Say it all at once.
Jessica Jones.
Yes. All right. That is quiz time. Thank you all so much for listening. Thank you, our pal Buzzy. And we will see you next week.